Telecast, the TV industry news review.
Hi, I'm Justin Crosby, and welcome to this week's Telecast. Joining me on this week's show are Kasper Pfluger, Managing Director of German broadcaster Sat.1, and Thomas Lukerath, Founder and Editor-in-Chief of German trade publication DWDL. And former industry veteran and non-executive director of K7 Media's Gary Carter takes us through the rise and fall of the super indies and the unscripted formats business. It's all coming up on this week's Telecast. So it's been a really big week for Telecast this week. We've passed the 5,000 download mark, and we've also been shortlisted for the Ingenuity and Innovation category in TBI's Content Innovation Awards. So thanks go to each and every one of the 40 industry guests from companies all around the world who've been on the show. We've had guests from some of the biggest TV and media industry corporations, including Facebook, Globo, Reed Meadem, All3 Media, Banerjee, Pluto TV and A&E, as well as indies, industry bodies and consultants. We've also had some of the world's leading industry journalists on the show to share their expertise, so thanks to them too. Thanks also, of course, to my regular partners in crime, K7 Media's Gert Sleesis and Deadline Hollywood's Peter White. We're going to be trying some new things in the coming weeks to keep things fresh, including a new spin-off show that I'll be announcing soon. So do get in touch with any suggestions for topics and guests. We're on LinkedIn and we're also on Facebook. We're also going to be running some special MIPCOM shows in October, where we'll round up all the key news stories of each day of the market and analyse what they mean. Plus, we'll interview a different leading distributor each day about their MIPCON slate. So, if you're interested in sponsoring one of these shows, please email me on justin@boomdialogue.com. That address is also in the episode description. On with this week's show, and we're taking our first look at the German TV market and how it's been coping over the past few months. I'm delighted to welcome Kasper Pfluger, Managing Director of ProSiebenSat.1, and Sat.1 Gold. Before Sat.1, Kasper was Programme Director of RTL Croatia and has also spent time as Daytime Programme Controller for Channel 5 in the UK. Sat.1 features US series such as Navy SEALs LA, Criminal Minds and Prodigal Son, plus German scripted and unscripted shows such as Bosch and Married at First Sight, in-house shows from its production and distribution network, Red Arrow Studios. International formats on Sat.1 include The Voice of Germany, The Taste, Dancing on Ice, The Masked Singer, Germany's Next Top Model, and reality shows Big Brother and The Biggest Loser. And joining Kasper is Thomas Lukerath, founder and editor-in-chief of DWDL. Before setting up the business, Thomas worked for German public broadcaster WDR, as well as NBC Europe, and studied political science in Duisburg. In the early years of DWDL, he also worked as an editor for German regional newspaper Rheinische Post in Düsseldorf. DWDL is the largest non-English trade publication for the European TV industry, focusing on the German-speaking markets, with a monthly reach of 900,000 unique users. Coverage includes daily news, interviews, reviews, analysis, and comment on industry topics. The site's got no paywall and it's open to everyone to access. The team is based in Cologne and Vienna. So, welcome to the show, Kasper and Thomas.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thomas, coming to you first. Now, I've been keen to take a look at the German TV market ever since I started Telecast. It's obviously economically huge territory, very important on the world TV stage, but perhaps a little underrepresented, particularly on the international content industry news agenda. For those a little unfamiliar, or let's say not experts with the German market, can you start by giving us a quick overview of the TV landscape in Germany?
Well, the German TV landscape is in a way similar to the one in the UK. We have a very strong public broadcasting system. We have two operators, actually, ARD and ZDF, two public service broadcasters managing several channels. The difference maybe to the UK is that they alone have more than 25 channels operating nationwide, which brings them to a huge market share. On the commercial side, we have the two big players, the RTL Group and ProSiebenSat.1, who are in the commercial free-to-air market, also in the pay market, and of course, nowadays also in the video-on-demand market. But basically, these are the big two players with several channels from the commercial side. Everybody, of course, knows Sky. Sky is available in Germany. We have Sky Deutschland. Maybe it's good to know that Sky in Germany is not nearly as big and as important as in the UK. Well, the last numbers they published were they were about 5 million subscribers, so not even half the numbers of the UK. And just last week, something changed a little bit in the German market space. Discovery became the third biggest family of channels in Germany. They acquired a small channel called Tele5, and now they have actually a couple of free-to-air channels, but on a very, very small scale, more in the factual space. When it comes to the production landscape, I would say it's basically the same mixture of indies and the big players. And just this summer, as in many markets, maybe Banijay stepped up with the acquisition of Endemol-Shine Germany. So now in the German space, they are the biggest production family.
When it comes to streamers, who are the dominant streamers? Are they the companies that you would expect, like Netflix and Amazon Prime? Or are there any particularly interesting domestic streamers that are doing particularly well?
If only anybody would know the answer to that. I guess nobody is publishing numbers. So the assumptions or the analytics we have say that Netflix and Amazon Prime are the two big ones. And then we have the local platforms. We have the RTL Group with TV Now. They are linear channels. They are catch-up TV and more exclusive titles. And then we have Joyn, which is a joint venture of ProSiebenSat.1 and Discovery. And they even go further. They don't only have their own channels. They want to be basically a provider of TV linear experiences mixed with on-demand services and also original shows. And then, of course, we have the VOD platforms from ARD and ZDF, which are quite popular. ZDF, one of the public broadcasters, was actually the first channel in Germany to offer a so-called Mediathek like 11 years ago, I think.
And how about production companies? I mean, in the UK, for example, we have the ability to retain rights, international rights for domestic commissions as a terms of trade. Does the same sort of ruling apply in Germany?
Interestingly, no. We have a different model. Well, it changed a little bit over the last, 5 years. But traditionally, a German production company would produce and sell all rights to the platform or the broadcaster. So this has been one of the reasons, actually, why I think not so many creative ideas came out of Germany to the international market, because production companies weren't able to actually afford a development team and afford all you need to create new ideas, because it was basically a business: get a job, get it done, get paid, move on. And you couldn't really build on your own expertise as much as some companies in the UK, maybe.
Is that likely to change?
It actually changed. We have a couple of companies who very early on, one is Brainpool, now a part of Banijay in Germany. They said, please, you can air a couple of times, but then the rights for our shows, even in the domestic space, are ours. So they actually run their own VOD service, myspaß.de, which is quite unusual. And we see a few more companies trying to hold back the rights for international marketing and international sales. And also we see so many, I mean, as in every market around the world, we see international co-productions. So on a very early stage, having other partners than just the domestic broadcaster.
If I could add another thought just here, because I think another thing that really, I think Thomas is totally right. Another thing, though, that's really in the past been, I think, a big difference between the German market and, say, for instance, the British market, demand for production is very much driven by schedule needs. And now that, you know, that sounds like an obvious thing, but when I say schedule needs, I really mean yeah, the continuity and the routine of the schedule is rules over everything. Yeah. So whereas in the UK, for instance, I've always felt that channels are much more ready to sort of mix up the schedule when a great idea comes along. You don't always have to have the same kind of genre and the same kind of tone and theme on a Tuesday at 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. You can, you know, when a great idea comes along that doesn't fit at all into what's happened in the same slot the weeks before, then it really doesn't matter. And I think sort of that approach, sort of idea first and then sort of schedule later, in the sense that, you know, if there's a great idea, we'll find a place for it in the schedule. You know, that has always been the case in Germany as well. But I think sort of if you look at the balance, then in Germany, it's always in the past been more towards sort of the priority has always been the continuity of the schedule, whereas in many other markets, it's been the sort of the originality of the ideas, maybe. You know, a lot of channels have always prided themselves, have always taken great pride in their viewers knowing that for years and years and years on a Thursday night, it would always be that kind of a show. But that's really changed. And I think also channels are willing to experiment a lot more. I mean, we've just done 5 consecutive nights of Celebrity Big Brother primetime shows. We've never done that in the past. Like that was unheard of. You'd say, well, you clear the schedule for a whole week, prime time, 5 nights in a row. That's, you know, that's scary. That's crazy, because, you know, what will the viewers think, who usually expect on a Tuesday to be a show of that type and then on a Wednesday of that type? And so we're more willing to experiment in the schedule. And I think that really liberates the market for ideas as well.
We were talking actually about soap operas a couple of weeks ago on Telecast with Gary Carter, and he pointed out that some of the main German soaps actually never stopped production during the pandemic, which is remarkable. Was it just soaps, or how did production continue?
Actually, the production stopped quite a few times, but only for a couple of days whenever there was a COVID-19 test which came back positive. So I think what Gary meant that in the airing of the show, there has never been a disruption. You had all your daily shows on air every day of the week like you're used to. There were actually a few episodes produced just as a precaution, just as a safety net. They produced some flashback episodes. They didn't need them because they could produce better than they were expecting. Just over Easter, they had 10 to 14 days, depending on the production. They had a short break. But besides that, production-wise, they could have done all they wanted. And on air, the show went through without interruption. I just was surprised to see that in the UK, some of the daily shows were like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or cutting off 2 episodes per week. No, we haven't seen that. As Kasper mentioned, we came through this pandemic actually without big changes in the scheduling due to coronavirus.
We've all, I think, looked over to Germany and seen the test and trace and the precautions that have been in action very, very early in this pandemic, and, you know, the control of the virus, which Germany seems to have been able to exercise, has been amazing. Obviously, that's helped with TV production as well. Thomas, also, how about your business? Now, most trade publications have been suffering as event income has been a key pillar in their businesses in recent years, right across every trade publication, really, around the world. And you don't have a subscription model either. So how has your business been weathering the storm?
Better than I would have thought back in March, actually.
Right.
We have never had an event business, not an important event business. So this was no problem for us. And we never actually have been a print medium. We started as an online-only publication 19 years ago, which actually helped us staying a small company with just a few people, which helped a lot in this year. I mean, the biggest saving for us was obviously we have had no travel budget. That went down to zero immediately. And so we didn't go to MIPTV, to the LA screenings. Now the Emmys had all these costs went down. So we actually came through quite good. We are ad financed and we saw still a big interest in using our reach to advertise, thankfully. And also we have the biggest job market for the TV industry. And of course, in March and April, it went down as well. But starting in May, I would say, and then June, we saw companies getting back to work. They thought they could produce safely enough. And the positivity in the market, I would say, came back by summer. So actually, we did quite well due to that.
Glad to hear that. Casper, so you're managing director of Sat.1s. For those unfamiliar with the channel, can you give us a brief overview?
Yeah, so Sat.1 is the first and oldest commercial channel in Germany, and we're one of the really big general interest channels in Germany. So with a sort of female skew, with a focus on women 30 to 49, but really a big focus on family audiences. So you find a lot of the big shows. On us, we're the broadcaster of The Voice. We've also got The Bake Off, for instance, is a show on our channel. So a lot of big shiny floor shows, big realities. I've mentioned Celebrity Big Brother, really broad entertainment channel.
How do you tend to work with the international market when it comes to commissions and acquisitions? You mentioned a couple of formats. I mean, presumably big international formats are really key to your schedule.
Yes, absolutely. No, formats are a big key of our success. And I mean, you know, in Germany, we're fortunate in that most of the big international production companies have their own subsidiaries here. So basically, we talk to our, you know, our German partners in Endemol Shine or in Bunny Jai or in Fremantle or, you know, any of those, any of those big or Three Media, etc. But obviously, through the markets, we interact with our international partners directly as well. A lot of the business actually goes through the German subsidiaries of these international partners. We do have a very good internal department that does a continuous monitoring of international development. So we get all the overnights from most of the big territories every day. So that way, sort of, you know, we find out very quickly if something's come up in any international market that has done particularly well. And then we can even get recordings ourselves very fast. That's a great advantage of being part of a big group such as ProSiebenSat.1, in that we have this infrastructure of international monitoring. And then we can be very fast in talking to our local partners. There are a few cases where really we buy sort of from the indie market where the original production company doesn't have an outlet in Germany. I'm just thinking of, because we just had a successful episode of it on air last night, Rich House, Poor House, for instance, the Hattrick format. So that's a format that we bought sort of directly from Hattrick in the UK. These days, it's more common that we talk to the local subsidiaries because most of them have one.
And how about drama? I mean, is drama an important cornerstone of your schedule as well?
It's always been an important part of the schedule, but it's sort of in recent years, we've done less of it. To be perfectly honest with you, I think we've realized that it's kind of drama is particularly tricky at the moment, I find, with, on the one hand, sort of the streamers offering amazing production budgets, highly serialized concepts, big event dramas, and then us sort of still coming from a tradition of the best drama for the schedule is one that runs for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and is self-contained and can be repeated, sort of, you know, the German version of a Vera, Inspector Mosley, those kinds of shows. And we've been doing those for a really long time, and we realized that that's no longer what audiences want. But then it's really hard on the high-end drama side to compete with the streamers on a sort of continuing basis, in the sense, you know, we used to have two drama slots a week for 50 weeks of the year. We no longer have that. We now focus more on sort of highlights and big tentpole event series every now and then. We do those in co-production, for instance, with our streaming platform Join. There's been less drama in our schedule in recent years.
that's more due to market forces than necessarily what the audience is demanding.
No, I think it's also down to what the audience is demanding, because we realize it's still hard to sort of, you know, really punch through with big serialized shows that where you try to keep the audiences engaged over weeks and weeks. That's still something where sort of our schedule logic, our grid logic, is sort of a contradiction to what people want and expect, in the sense, you know, they want to binge and watch everything in one go. Yeah. And on the other hand, sort of the thing that we've been doing for a long time, the sort of, you know, crime case of the week or hospital drama of the week, is no longer in such demand. You know, it can come across as a little bit bland compared to some of the exciting stuff that people, you know, are getting elsewhere. We're focused on big ideas, tent poles, event dramas, 6 to 8 episodes. We can do that. We do them either as a local co-production with our streaming platform. We can also do them as international co-production. We're not less keen on drama than we used to be. We're just finding it harder to find the sort of great ideas that justify the big investment and that hopefully come with the big audiences that we need.
There's an opportunity for some drama producers to come to you with some great ideas.
Absolutely.
Remarkably, you're only the second broadcaster that we've had on the show after all these months, with Viasat coming on a few weeks back. How about viewing figures over the summer? I'm assuming you've seen a similar surge in viewing figures to many of the other networks and platforms.
The numbers have really been amazing. We've had a great surge in viewership. Obviously, a lot of it driven by sort of news programs, news specials, etc. But we've really seen viewership pick up across the board. And then, you know, maybe not surprisingly, especially for big escapist entertainment ideas, which we were, you know, lucky enough to have to produce some earlier in the year to be able to show them around April, May, when people felt particularly depressed that they weren't going to be able to, you know, not to go on holidays, but not even to leave the house.
Yeah.
So we were able to have a lot of great sort of escapist entertainment on the air. The numbers have been really fantastic. And I think it's been kind of like a resurgence of free-to-air TV and an ability for us to really showcase all the great stuff we can still find on telly. It's dipped a little over the summer now, obviously, because, you know, the lockdown had ended and the weather was brilliant. But we're seeing good numbers now already with the return after the summer holidays. For us, lockdown came, it could have come at a worse time, let me put it that way.
Yeah.
Because by mid of March, we had already produced all our big shows for spring. So everything was already done. And it left us enough time to prepare together with the production companies what needed to be done to make our big shows for the fall producible. Yeah. And so we very, very quickly, from the beginning of April on, together with our partners, with our production partners here in Germany, focused on, you know, how do we bring our big studio shows back? How do we produce our big reality shows, especially the ones that usually require going abroad? That really allowed us to prepare. And we're now, I'm really sort of, you know, knock on wood, it stays that way. But we're really on track with all our big shows for the fall. Because even if there's not another lockdown, we're very much expecting people, you know, we're very much expecting to be the sort of viewing behavior to still be somewhat different than, say, for last year. Because, you know, it's not that easy or maybe not even that comfortable to go out to restaurants, you know, clubs, bar, whatever other alternatives people usually have for entertainment, especially at night, is still kind of complicated. And so we want to make sure that this fall also, and coming in, going into the winter, we've got big, great entertainment of all genres for our viewers.
We're all getting back to work across Europe and around the world now. Kids going back to school, thank goodness. How do you see things playing out economically for the German industry, assuming that there's no major lockdown and no major disruptions? How do you see it economically playing out over the winter?
Cautiously optimistic would be the word, because I mean, obviously, you know, April and May on the advertising front have been very, very hard for us. But we've seen sort of a step-by-step recovery in recent months, and we're quite confident that that things will kind of get back to a closer to normal, let's put it that way, in the fall. Obviously, it'll be hard to make up for the drop in the spring, but definitely things are looking much brighter in the fall compared to how bad it was in, you know, April, May. That's why really very early on, we've made a very conscious sort of business decision, regardless of the sort of production implications of COVID. We said we want to continue to invest. We're talking to advertisers on a daily basis that they need to invest in advertising. And so we wanted to lead by example and show that it absolutely pays off to invest through the crisis.
And maybe I can add something there, because I think it's interesting to see that Sat.1, as Kaspar mentioned, ProSieben Sat.1, actually the company, took another approach than RTL in Cologne, because I talked to Jörg Graf, the managing director of RTL in Cologne, and they actually said in summer, we will continue to produce more as soon as the ad revenue comes back. So they were much more on the defensive side to say, we stay put, we will see what happens, and if the money comes back, we will go back into big productions. ProSiebenSat.1 on the other side said, well, if we expect our advertisers to continue to invest, we need to invest as well. That was interesting to see two competitors, which usually are not that far away from each other when it comes to policies like that, actually taking different approaches in Germany.
That's interesting. I mean, how is the overall German economy, how has that been managing? Have you had a furlough scheme in the same way that lots of other territories?
No, we've had a big furlough scheme.
Is that still in action right now?
Yes, it's been extended. And I think that probably has cushioned off. I don't know. Is that an expression?
Yeah.
Yeah, that has sort of cushioned off a big part of the immediate impact in April and May, because it's helped a lot of companies, big and small, to sort of temporarily adjust to the crisis.
And presumably that will have a big impact on, you know, people, businesses coming out of furlough and then deciding whether or not they can retain employees.
Yeah.
And therefore consumer spending being impacted. I mean, is the furlough scheme is it running indefinitely, or is it, because in the UK it finishes in the end of October, and it's already sort of winding down now in terms of the percentage that the government is contributing. In Germany, is it open-ended?
It's not totally, but it's been extended into next year. I'm not sure until when exactly next year, but it's been extended into next year.
Wow.
But really, I mean, what has been, and I'm sure the same is true in the UK and in many other markets, it's been particularly tough on the arts, if you like, in the broadest sense, because obviously the culture business has been hit hardest, with theaters, big live events, everything closed down still. You know, we do a lot in the comedy genre. We have a lot of shows and artists under contract. And for them and sort of their entire crews, it's been a big, big impact and continues to do so. And one where even the furlough doesn't really help, because at the moment there's just no perspective for when you can go back to the live touring business.
Yep.
Cinemas have started to open up. Tenet has just launched quite successfully. Was it last week, I think?
I think so.
I'm not totally sure. But for the culture business, beyond telly, it's been very tough. And there's still some very big restrictions at work.
Thomas, Bundesliga has come back much earlier and really sort of set the model and really led the way for televised football coming back on our screens all over Europe. So thank you for that. But I gather there's been some disagreements around rights on the Bundesliga.
First of all, you're welcome. And yes, there has been some confusion about the Bundesliga rights. Basically, back in 2016, Eurosport secured the rights to some Bundesliga games, but later sold them to DAZN during the rights period. And now, this year, Eurosport refused to pay a final installment for the Bundesliga rights to Bundesliga. So they actually gave the rights directly to DAZN. So far, so good. Everything's fine. Not really, because Amazon was also transporting Eurosport. They have these Amazon channels, and Eurosport was on it. And apparently, Amazon has good lawyers, because Amazon wanted to have the promised Bundesliga matches. So instead of taking legal actions, they took another approach on a Friday afternoon, just hours before a match was supposed to start at the Bundesliga, at the beginning of the rest of the Bundesliga season after COVID, after the COVID break, they announced that Amazon suddenly has Bundesliga. And the way they did it was basically they said, well, Eurosport, let's produce a show out of your studio with your crew, but not under the Eurosport label, but directly for Amazon Prime. So that way Amazon got what they wanted and Eurosport could it got away without any legal actions from Amazon. And that was quite interesting because all of a sudden, just hours before a game, there was the announcement made that Amazon now has Bundesliga. And interestingly enough, they will continue to do that for this upcoming season because it's the last one of this rights period. And but for the further years ahead, they didn't participate in the bidding process for Bundesliga rights. So it's just a very short intermezzo for Amazon on the Bundesliga scale. They focus on the Champions League. They bought the Champions League rights from 2021 in Germany. So they have Champions League. But I guess there's somebody else who is quite happy about the decisions made this summer about Bundesliga from 2021 on, because Sat.1's Kasper's channel has bought the free-to-air package, so he will be the only free-to-air channel in Germany showing Bundesliga for free.
So Bundesliga this season, which is just about to start, or just starting now, we have DAZN, we don't have Eurosport, we have Sat.1.
Sat.1 is just joining for the next period of rights, which starts 2021. This season, it's obviously Sky. Still, the most games are on Sky. Then DAZN has the package, which used to be on Eurosport. But due to the fact, the legal part, Amazon has all the games, DAZN has as well.
Interesting.
Definitely. I don't see myself getting a DAZN subscription because I can see the Bundesliga games on Amazon Prime as well. I hope it makes sense for DAZN. So far, we haven't heard any complaints.
The fact that they can't have crowds in the stadiums as well further complicates these rights issues, right? Because, I mean, fans want to see every show from the comfort of their own home if they can't attend.
Definitely. I mean, Bundesliga will be watched more than ever from home or maybe from pubs and bars if they get the crowd control in place. But yeah, definitely. We saw huge rating figures for the Bundesliga this summer when they returned, because obviously everybody was craving for live sports. And there it was. And it has viewing figures like never seen before.
I was craving football so much that I resubscribed to BT Sport just to watch the Bundesliga games. And that was unusual in its own right, because I think that we were just getting used to these artificial crowd noises and the whole concept of football behind closed doors, which is almost become the norm now, sadly.
Yeah, but sadly, I think it will still stay the same for the upcoming months, yeah.
So now it's the time in the show where we get to discuss the stories of the week with our guests. Thomas, kick us off with your chosen industry news story.
Yeah, let's talk about Ich bin ein Star, holt mich hier raus, the German version of I'm a Celebrity, get me out of here. RTL, the German channel, and ITV Studios Germany haven't decided yet where to produce this year's version. Will they go to Australia or will they follow the lead of ITV and go to the UK in January? That's a decision to be made within the next couple of weeks, we were told. And so far, they haven't made up their mind. I mean, producing in Australia seems to be a bit odd, given the fact that most of the German companies don't let their employees back in the office yet, and then suddenly sending a crew to produce a TV show around the world in Australia. Difficult. Also, the quarantine in Australia makes it difficult, because the German version usually airs in the early January. So airing this season as usual would mean you have to quarantine all your celebrities over Christmas, which I think nobody would want to, even if you have a bigger paycheck. So I would say they will move to the UK. That's what I assume, because it's the safer way to do so. And also you get the moment of surprise. And we all learned from The Masked Singer last year, the what the hell moment when you have a big brand and you have something, you expect something and you get something different. I would say try the UK, and if it's not working, you can go back to Australia and do the big comeback of the Jungle Camp in 2022.
Necessity drives invention. So who knows? Maybe a format reinvention if it happens in this castle in Wales, which I believe the ITV version is being shot. Interesting. Are there any other examples of reality formats in Germany that have been shot abroad over the last couple of months, or have they all been sort of cancelled?
Definitely. For example, Love Island. I mean, the German version of Love Island is currently being filmed in Mallorca, actually, in September. It's a few months after the usual time for the British version, so they had this advantage. But also they had, on the very first day of production, their host actually got a positive COVID-19 test.
Right.
The worst possible thing you can have. But they isolated her, and thankfully they had a different host on location so she could take over. But they are moving on, and they are in production in Mallorca. But another show, The Summer House of Stars, actually was produced in a very lovely, small, basically unknown town on the German countryside. And it's starting this week. So it will be interesting to see how people react to a show which usually is filmed in a paradise environment. And now it's basically a farm somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Hmm. So we'll have the ratings at the end of the week.
But we spoiled people in recent years, of course, with amazing escapist locations. And yeah, we're going to Greece in a week to start the next shooting for the next season of Biggest Loser. And we're hoping to be able to go to Thailand in November, who knows, to shoot the second season of our blockbuster show that really had such a big impact in April when everyone was depressed at home. And we had fantastic pictures from Thai beaches. But we're not sure yet whether we'll be able to go. The logistics are not quite as complicated as for I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. So we're still debating.
Presumably, if there's a chance of getting out there, you'll do that. And I'm sure that you'll be rewarded with good viewing figures, because I think everybody still is going to, particularly when we're coming up to winter months, going to want a bit of that escapism, as they haven't been able to go to warmer climes. Casper, what's your story of the week?
So my story of the week is a story about Sat.1. It's a story that we published last week, the fact that a very renowned German comedian, Ralf Schmitz, great, great guy, fantastic comedian, is switching channels and joining us exclusively. And the reason that's a sort of a story of the week for me is that we've been talking a lot about formats now, but I think what's equally important for sort of a TV and creative business more generally is really talent. And when I say talent, I don't just mean sort of on-screen talent, but also off-screen talent, because really it's about people who make great shows, who appear in great shows. And so that's why this has been sort of an important step for us. And it just reminds me of the importance of talent sort of in combination with great formats. It's a business, but we also need to ensure that we create an environment and a context for people free and safe so that they can come up with the best possible ideas.
Have we seen COVID-19 increase the price of talent?
No, I don't think we have. But you know, with these things, it's so hard to generalize. It hasn't gone down, I can say that much.
I've just wondered in terms of scarcity and demand, and also in terms of if productions have been delayed, then presumably schedules of talent is being moved around as well. So presumably, there will be a premium on certain talent.
What's definitely changed is availability. A lot of great talent that we work with doesn't do TV exclusively. So a lot of them are musicians or comedians who usually are on tour for a large part of the year. And so for large parts of the year, their schedules are blocked and we can't shoot any TV shows with them. That's definitely changed. So availability has changed, and that is very nice. I can't say that the costs have gone down as a consequence. Sort of being able to do more with many of these amazing talents is definitely a very nice side effect.
So now is the time of the show where every week we get to nominate our hero of the week and who or what they want to get in the bin. So Casper, tell us about your hero of the week.
We must never forget that what we do is a people business, and a lot of what we do is, you know, sort of dealing with people and creating an environment where they feel safe and good. And my most important sounding board for questions and issues around people in the broader sense is my wife. And my wife doesn't work in television at all. She works in a very different area, but she's just a great, great sounding board for me for any such questions. She does have very high standards. It's sometimes very hard to live up to them, but she's always a great challenger that makes her my hero of the week.
Right. Okay. And that's the first interfamilial hero of the week that we've had on telecast. So Casper, your wife, what's your wife's name, Casper?
Teresa.
Okay. Teresa is your hero of the week. And who or what do you want to get in the bin?
I had to think about this for a bit, but then I realized there's one thing that's been annoying me for many, many months now. And what's annoying me even more is that I've started to use it myself, and that's WhatsApp voice messages. I think with sort of communication, especially now in a home office context, is getting trickier and trickier. You get more misunderstandings because emails and WhatsApps, and they're all great for quick sort of for quick exchanges, but often they're also just, you know, a sort of a lazy excuse for avoiding the direct sort of dialogue and interaction. And I think WhatsApp voice messages, I just, with every WhatsApp voice message that I receive, I just always think you could have just picked up the receiver. You could have just literally picked up the phone and given me a ring, and we could have talked about it rather than sort of talking in parallel.
So it's literally where you can decide to actually record a message and send it to somebody. I mean, if that's becoming a trend, then I'm getting off WhatsApp because it sounds terrible.
Dialogue and talking about something and discussing something together, and maybe because of a dialogue coming to an even sort of new idea, it's just a sort of parallel exchange of voicemail files. Yeah, it's just.
Yeah, exactly. Is that in common circulation in Germany, the WhatsApp audio message habit?
I think more so, Thomas. I mean, do you?
It's really annoying, I have to say. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's easy for the one who sends it, but I mean, if you're on a train, if you're waiting at the airport, or even like just sitting at a table with other people, you can't hear them. So just text, please.
Or call me. Give me a call. Let's talk.
That's borderline rude, I have to say. That's borderline rude. I really hope that, I mean, maybe I haven't come across that yet, but maybe maybe it's just me. Maybe everybody else is doing it apart from me. But if that's the case, then long may that remain the case. Thomas, who or what is your hero of the week?
Well, my hero of the week is the longest running German crime show, Tatort. And for one reason, on Sunday, actually, the German national team played against Switzerland in the Nations League. It was unheard of that a program would beat the German national team, because if there's football on free-to-air television, it usually wins, especially if it's the national team. But Tatort returned this Sunday. Strangely enough, they won reruns all summer. Just on this Sunday against the national team, they showed the first new Tatort episode of the season, and it got bigger ratings than the football. And the worst thing of it, it was an Austrian story, because Tatort is produced from various regional partners. And so an Austrian Tatort, performed better than the German national team.
Yogi must not have liked that, yeah.
Okay, all right. And who or what are you chucking in the bin, Thomas?
Something which annoyed me for so many years, actually, is the fact that Netflix is labeling anything they actually buy as a Netflix original. And I think it's unfair to the creative minds behind so many programs who originated at national channels or were bought and just relabeled, and the second window programming, which I just talked to ZDF head of program Norbert Himmler, and he said that the ZDF is selling a lot of documentaries to Netflix, but then Netflix labeled it as a Netflix original. And he said that this needs to end. And I myself think it's unfair for the talent behind these shows and the credit you just give Netflix and not the original companies. I have to say Amazon is doing it a little better. They actually have Amazon Originals and Amazon Exclusive. I would say most of the people don't know the difference, but at least they are trying.
Hmm. What constitutes a Netflix original has been something of a confusion for me over the last few years, I have to say. And I think you might find that the producers, when they're offered a Netflix deal, will pretty much say, you can call it whatever you want, if that's the budget.
That's true. But I think about all the second window program. I mean, if Netflix just buying a show which was on air in Germany, we had, for example, a very successful German drama shows 2 years ago, Bad Banks, about the financial world. It was a hugely successful German TV program, originally for German television. And Netflix just picked up, I think 6 or 8 weeks later, the second window of this program and labeled it a Netflix original. And this is something where I would say it's damaging the reputation of German producers and channels if they don't get the credit for being the original company and broadcaster of a program.
Well, that's a very fair point. That'd be interesting to hear from Netflix. What constitutes a Netflix original and what doesn't? Interesting. Thomas, Casper, thank you so much for your time this week. Really enjoyed talking with you guys about Germany, about Sat.1, and about DWDL and how things have been going over there. Hope to have you on the show at some point again in the future. Obviously, we only scratched the surface when it comes to looking at the German market, but it's been really interesting to have you on the show. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
So it's that time in the show where we usually catch up with Gert Sleesis, but sadly he can't be with us this week. But I am delighted to welcome back another member of the K7 Media team. Welcome back, Gary Carter.
Hello, Justin. Thanks for having me again.
Well, thank you for coming back just a couple of weeks after your first appearance, which is when we were talking about soaps and how many of the European soaps actually started life as scripted formats. And we talked about giving birth, in a way, to the format industry and the rise of the super indie. So this week, I wanted to look at non-scripted and the super indies. Now, you've been active in non-scripted formats since the 80s.
I'm afraid that's true, Justin. Yeah.
Well, there's an amazing font of knowledge that I'm wanting to tap into, if you can tap into a font. Can you sketch out your involvement in the unscripted format business and share with us how that trade has developed since then, since the 80s?
Sure. I suppose I should just put in a caveat in that I'm not obviously an historian, right? But I was around. And so my recounting of the narrative is probably partial, but I think that the insights hold. I started working in the industry in 1986 when I became an assistant, or the assistant, his only assistant, to a man called Roger Hancock. And Roger was the brother of Tony Hancock, the very, very famous British comedian. And Roger had become an agent because he managed his brother's career as Tony moved from the last days of Music Hall into radio and into television. Many of the group of artists, performers, writers, and producers who were around Tony at that time did the same thing. So this was a small family agency with a very, very powerful base. It was a client base. It was also the 80s when individuals in British television particularly were starting to form their own limited companies as tax vehicles for their own services. And simultaneously, it was a time at which commercial television broadcasting was really starting to open up in the UK and across Britain. So the foundations, I suppose, in Britain of what became ITV, but the beginnings of what became RTL in across Europe, the Scandinavian broadcasters 3 and 5, and so on. And this this liberalization of the market or the opening up of the market beyond public broadcasters meant that many producer directors who had been dependent on work from public broadcasters were now starting to seek work from commercial actors. And those commercial broadcasters didn't have a shortage of production capability. I mean, they could get access to production capability. But what I think happened was producers, directors started to realize that they needed ideas to get into the door, to be commissioned, and that ideas were the scarcity, not production capacity. What happened was Roger had a client called Jeremy Fox. Jeremy Fox had a personal vehicle called Action Time. Roger spent part of the year in America, and he started to acquire the rights for the UK to American game shows, Catchphrase amongst them, for example, and import them into the UK. Originally, I think, for Jeremy to produce, but later to sell on, as it were.
And that was the first time that had been done, essentially.
I think it's the first time that a UK producing entity had started to import non-scripted formats into America at anything like a regular pattern, and also then started to realize it could push them to Europe. And if it could do that, it should be able to pull them from Europe into the UK. So after Jeremy Fox, who then went on to found the Digital Right Group, now part of the Nent Group, after Jeremy sold to Carlton, Stephen Leahy, a doyen of British game shows, came in. Trish Kinane, now the executive producer of Got Talent in America and American Idol. And they formed what you might call an association, almost like a trade association of burgeoning independent producers across Europe, one in each territory. And there was a reciprocal relationship between all these parties, and they traded in each other's ideas. The members of that so-called action group became very, very significant and have continued careers in British and European television. So Kerry Lewis Brown, in fact, the founder of said K7 that Gertz and I have the pleasure of working with, Kerry was, in fact, the head of sales at Action Time. But the companies in that group included companies represented by Michelle Rodrigue, who went on to found Distraction, and now the Format people, the three founders of Jess Music, now Jess Music Endemol, part of the Banijay Group, Annie Vigelius, the late Annie Vigelius, who went on to become director of programs at the Swedish public broadcaster, but who built one of the first Scandinavian independent groups across the Nordics, which was later sold. These people were in search of ideas, and the trade was very, very simple. You can have first look on what I have. And this model of understanding the power and the value of scripted formats, the lessons learned by companies like Jess Music when they were in the action group, is one of the reasons, one of the logic points behind the rise of the super indies. At that time, I would say there were maybe, when I went to Cannes in 1980, through the late 80s and into the early 90s, maybe there were 150 people employed in this trade with any kind of regularity. And I would say the overwhelming majority of them were producers. It's only later that broadcasters started to scan different markets and to acquire directly from the owners of said formats. But the industry as it started was a kind of cottage industry, I would say.
And so these individuals now that were part of this alliance, if you like, an action group, they really went on to become the formation in as individuals as some of the global super indies that we see today.
Yes, I would say, what I would say is that the understanding of the power of the trading in non-scripted formats became a strategic weapon in the consolidation of those super indies. So if we look, for example, at Endemol, latterly Endemol Shine and now Banijay, if we look at Endemol, it's a good example. I was here, I was around them, I was doing business with them. These were two production companies, the largest two production companies, and probably the first two or three production companies to emerge in Holland after the arrival of RTL and SBS. John de Mol and Joop van den Ende very quickly realized that there was a limit on their growth in such a small country. And also, and realized that they would have to spread to other countries. And they realized, because they had learned the lessons, for example, Joop van den Ende was indeed a member of the Action Group, had learned the value of having an arsenal of rights at your disposal that generated production. And so when they moved into Germany and then into Belgium and then into Sweden and then across the world, what they were looking for was themselves, in a sense. They were looking for entrepreneurial, creative producers who could generate intellectual property. Because at the heart of the expansion of Endemol in the late 90s and in the early 2000s when I worked there was the idea that if you generated intellectual property, if you were as entrepreneurial and as creative as the founders of Endemol, you would understand what was at stake. So the rights trading was the core business model, I would say, of almost all of these companies and some of the later arrivals like BBC Worldwide, which only really went into production several years later. And of course, in the face of all of that, the industry became far more complex. The actual trade in formats became far more complex. And how those properties were handled and rolled out became far more complex. And I think a turning point of that was 1999, Paul Smith and Celador Productions' handling of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which I think was a game changer in a business sense. And that's very, very rare because he took strategic decisions that nobody had ever taken before.
And it's that IP, isn't it? We're going back to the power of that IP in terms of, I remember Who Wants to Be a Millionaire at one point was, you know, number one show around the world, as obviously you do as well. But also, I think it was also the number one video game for a number of years.
Let's say before Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the deal was very simple. I have a format that you like, Justin. You pay me a little bit of money to reserve the rights for a couple of months. By the way, that show had probably been on air at least 3 years in my home country because it needed to have an established identity. So it's, my show's been on air for 3 years in Holland. You come along, you're part of this association, you pick up the show. The deal is very, very simple. There's almost no paperwork. You pay me amount of money per show. It rises by X percent in subsequent series. And by the way, I don't want to control your output at all. I just want a credit. I want the money. And I don't want to control the look and feel. I don't particularly care if you change the structure as long as you accept that I own all the changes you make. And you can have the print, publication, and merchandising rights as well. Then Paul Smith, with Millionaire, realizes he has something particular on his hands very quickly, partly because of its initial success in the UK and partly because at that time, companies had started to scan the activities of other markets. So John DeMol and I had been tracking Millionaire for some time. The shows were couriered to Holland overnight. We watched them in the morning, and I was on a plane back to Britain to meet with Paul Smith the next day. What Paul did was to enforce what we would now call a brand image. The same logo, the same music, the same lighting style, the same kind of choreography and look and feel in all of the productions. There were very few deviations from this. But secondly, he also retained all the merchandising rights to himself. So licensees were paid a percentage of that income, but the rights were controlled by Celador. So on the one hand, then this was his genius. He understood that he needed to build a global brand, that wherever you went around the world, you should be able to turn on the television and recognize that this was Millionaire. And secondly, you could leverage that brand value into big global deals for video games and other forms of ancillary publication. And we at Endemol learned the lesson very well from Paul because he was a close partner to Endemol, who had the show in 14 countries. And we used much of that thinking when we came to license Big Brother. And I think that those two shows, but particularly Paul Smith's handling of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, really set the ground for the maturity of the format industry.
And talking about Banerjee, Endemol Shine, and the Super Indies, obviously the recent acquisition, and looking at those remaining Super Indies in these most disruptive of times. What do you think the outlook is for the Super Indies?
I'm not optimistic. When I worked with Tony Cohen, the CEO at Fremantle, he used to call me the shroud waver of the format industry. And I suppose in some ways I am. Look, the industry has been in decline for a very long time. It would be naive to maintain that that is not the case. And I think that that decline has escalated. The decline in gross profit, the consolidation of the industry, the scarcity of new globally successful formats on the scale of anything before the launch of The Voice in around 2007, and above all, the challenges to the centrality of television as a form of audiovisual media, has been exacerbated by the arrival of the online players like Netflix. I mean, this was the moment that the internet was waiting for. And now, of course, the COVID has also thrown a question mark over many of the non-scripted format principles, you know, studio audiences, large groups of people, lots of open mouths, cheering, all of those kinds of things. I also think that we've backed ourselves into a corner in some ways in trade. But the formation of these big consolidated companies, first of all, created a kind of walled garden. And by that, I mean acquiring formats. If you are a local production company that is part of a conglomerate of a super indie, became increasingly difficult, because why would anybody sell to you? Because you're selling to the dominant opposition potentially. Secondly, these production companies, by and large, their distribution arm stopped selling formats to other players who are outside of the group. And so these kind of walled gardens emerged. And I think it's one of the reasons why we see relatively few acquired formats being launched in the last 5 or 6 years by a company like Fremantle Media, or Fremantle as it is now. But I think that the real question in the face of an organization like Banijay, Endemol, after all, it's Banijay, Zodiac, Endemol, Shine, right? And the real question is, what do you do with it? It seems to me that it represents a kind of top of the mountain of consolidation. And I assume that either they have a plan or they have no plan and are trying to work out what to do with it. I'm talking about Marco Bassetti, who, by the way, was also active in the format trade at the period that I've talked about. And of course, Stéphane Corbi, who founded Banijay, was the CEO of CAS ASP, which became Endemol France. Peter Langenberg, who's the COO, worked with me at Endemol when I was there in the early years of the 2000s. But I suspect that there is only one way out. I cannot imagine who you would think would buy Banijay. I cannot imagine that you think you're going to keep running Banijay until you retire. I suspect you might think that you're going to launch it on the stock market. But if you look at the performances of organizations like Nent on Swedish AIM, I'm not convinced that it's a strategy that delivers the returns that you might imagine, having gone to the trouble to put the thing together. It's certainly true that the largest pile of rights, of format rights, to enormously historically significant and still very vibrant shows is now under the control of Banijay. And I think that's a historic turning point. I could list them all for you. But, you know, in that catalogue, Fully Owned, Survivor, you've got MasterChef, you've got Big Brother, you could go on and on. It's historic, it's consolidated, and it points to my earlier thesis that these companies are not really production companies, they are rights distribution companies.
You mentioned some of those instantly recognizable names. We had Jan Salling on a few weeks ago on Telecast, and we were talking about coming to MIPTV and coming to MIPCOM, and he was saying, you know, it's been a number of years since we've seen one of these global hit formats really setting the market alight and exciting everybody. I suppose the nearest thing in the last few years has probably been The Masked Singer. Do you think we'll ever see another global hit format of the scale of, say, Got Talent?
I like to make a point that there are formats and there are super formats, right? And this little category, super formats, are those that travel at very, very high speed to more than, say, let's say 20 territories in the period of about 12 months. And for many years, thanks to Rob Clark at Fremantle, Got Talent held that crown and probably still does. I don't know that market conditions are right for the emergence of super formats like that. And by that, I mean, I'm not sure we have the size of audience that builds a compelling track record. I mean, obviously we have audiences and they build track records, but we're talking about a different league of conviction here. I'm not sure that we have the same sense within broadcasters that they need to jump onto international hits, because I think that one of the side effects of the current pandemic is a return to more local storytelling. And of course, many of these shows historically are either reality shows with rather large casts, or they are very big scale studio or location-based shows. And I'm not sure how you do that post-COVID. So I'll probably be proved wrong. I mean, I hope I am. But I kind of feel we've lived, if you like, through the maturity and now the decadence of the format industry, if you'll excuse me comparing the format industry to the Roman Empire, Justin.
I'm enjoying the analogy.
I said last time I was on your show that I didn't believe in arguments about golden age. We were talking about the golden age of scripted, and that I think arguments about golden ages are a little presumptuous. I was about to say that I think we've lived through the golden age of formats, but I'll forget that and I'll leave that to the historians to decide.
Right. We may see the format industry rolling along with smaller hits, but it's going to be very unlikely that we're going to see this global hit format due to, as you say, the conditions such as, you know, the fragmentation of markets and broadcasters and viewers. It's unlikely we'll see another Got Talent, but we might see a few more Masked Singers.
Well, yes, absolutely you might, and I'm sure you will. And that doesn't mean that the format business is not a vibrant trade, Justin. What I mean is that it probably no longer provides the fuel necessary for the super indies. If you're a smaller player, it's probably fine. And I think that rather like the high street, the hollowing out of the middle ground in retail and the fragmentation of the market into luxury at one end and small players at the other, I think that what's starting to happen is that those who might have considered themselves luxury brands are starting to feel the chill wind of winter coming.
Talking about winter, it's certainly going to be an interesting few months for the super indies because of their constituent parts and the shows that they're making or not making. So from a business perspective, that's possibly also going to shape the business of super indies for the next few years as well.
We're certainly living through a period in which, as a super indie, your distribution arm is becoming more and more important. Not so much your format distribution capacity in your own production network, but your finished tape distribution arm. This is your moment because, of course, there has been failure of program supply for very good reasons, interrupted production, all of those kinds of things, greater importance of reruns, real estate on broadcasters. On the one hand, you have, historically, these companies were built on a certain kind of economy of scale. And now what they have is a network of pipes that were laid for the flow of IP, but they don't really have the water flowing through the pipes anymore to the same degree that they did. Or at least more and more of the water's in the control of Banerjee.
Garrett, fascinating as ever. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on the non-scripted format business and super indie. It's been fascinating to chat to you about this, and I can't wait for you to come back on the show.
I look forward to the invitation, Justin, and I promise to be there if I get one.
Well, that's about it for another week's show. Thanks for listening. As ever, I hope you enjoyed it. Please remember to rate and subscribe to the show and share it with friends and colleagues on social media. If you want to hear more about our MIPCOM advertising and sponsorship packages, please email me at justin@boomdialogue.com. That's justin@boomdialogue.com. Telecast was edited by Ian Chambers. Next week, we're hopping over the border and taking a look at the TV markets in the Netherlands and Belgium and catching up with two of the industry leaders in these territories. So, until then, as always, stay safe.